One small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Cindy.
This week in history.
Well, when you look at your life, by the age of 30, what were your greatest achievements? Solid start to your career, maybe a family, maybe a mortgage. Well, for Alexander the Great, the name says it all. By the age of just 30, he'd created one of the largest empires in history, stretching from Greece to northwestern India. And in doing so, he didn't lose a single battle. But there is a saying, the flame that burns twice as bright burns half as long. And Alexander was dead at the age of 32. It was this week in 323 BC that Alexander died, not in battle, but of an illness. But in his short life, he became one of history's most famous military leaders and one of the most consequential figures of the ancient world. But what happened to his empire when he died? Well, Tristan Hughes is an ancient history expert. He's the host of History Hits, the ancient podcast. He's the author of a book called Alexander's Successors at War. He is also heading to Australia in August for a lecture series, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that later. Hello, Tristan. Lovely to have you on Nightlife.
Good afternoon, Suzanne. It's wonderful to be on the show. We're like half the world away here in London.
Yeah, well, excellent to be reaching out across the world to you as we, and I suppose Alexander was roaming somewhere in the middle of us this time, you know, a couple of thousand years
ago. That's an excellent drawing right there.
Yeah. So look, we want to focus quite a bit about what happened after Alexander died, which was June 10 or 11, 323 BC in Babylon. But we should really position ourselves to explain what happened, you know, with a reminder of how he went from being the son of the Macedon King Philip to conquering this huge empire that lay at his feet as he was dying. Macedonia had had a kind of military alliance with the Greek city-states, and then when Alexander inherited the throne from his father, he took on his father's plan to take on the Persian Empire. Why was that the burning drive to go and take Persia on?
Well, because Persia at that time is the superpower in the world. It stretches from the western fringes of modern day Turkey, to the Aegean Sea, just across from where Greece is, all the way to what is today like the Pamirs and the Hindu Kush and Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, even into the Indian subcontinent. And yes, Suzanne, there had been this alliance created between the Macedonians and the Greek cities. It had, must stress, been created through war, through a victory of Alexander the Great's father, King Philip, a series of campaigns in which he was able to quell the resistance of famous city-states we might think of immediately with the Greeks like Athens and Corinth and Thebes and so on. And once he'd done that, Alexander is only 20 years old at the time, but his dad is assassinated. And Alexander comes to power as the new king of Macedon. He asserts his control of his rising kingdom at that time on the Greek mainland, thanks to his dad. And then also with the army that his dad has very much set in motion, has kind of established the new kind of the formations, the battle tactics, the new equipment. This is the most modern army of the time. He continues what his dad wanted to do, which was to with this alliance with the Greek cities, who have also contributed troops, to march east, to start taking territory from the Persians and to see just how far he could go.
Were the Persians and the Greeks historic enemies?
Oh, it's an interesting one. There's been conflict between them in the past. So yes, you might immediately think of the great Persian wars between certain Greek cities and the Persian Empire that had occurred more than roughly 150 years before the time of Alexander and his campaigns. But that also, you must not always think of these two, you know, these ancient cultures, and kind of quotation marks, as being always at war. There are times when there was friendships, there was alliances between certain Greek cities and the Persians, particularly those subordinates, those governors of the Persian Empire who were controlling territory on its western fringes in the western area of what is today Turkey. But so yes, they had certainly a history of conflict, but not all the time. There certainly also was Persian influence and culture over Alexander the Great's royal house, for instance, over the Kingdom of Macedonia too.
Okay, so not necessarily a sense of revenge, but perhaps more a sense of what Alexander thinking, well, how great can I make my empire?
Well, no, there is still certainly that idea of revenge, because the Greeks, although the reality is that the Persians weren't always fighting against the Greeks in those 150 years since the Persian Wars, the memory of the Persian Wars is still very much embedded in many of the Greeks, and particularly like the philosophers of the time. And actually, how Alexander frames this conquest against the Persian Empire, this fighting against the Persians, one of the things is that revenge motive. It's revenge for the Persian invasions of Greece that 150 years earlier. But that is just, it's a pretext. It's a pretext to get the Greeks more on side, but it's certainly not the only reason why he wants to do it. He wants to, yes, it's also his personal desire to see how far he can go, to show, you know, that he is, in his idea, you know, he is a descendant of mythical figures like Achilles and Hercules as well.
Now, I'm interested, Tristan, too. I mean, Macedonia and Greece, are they, you know, do the Macedonians see themselves as Greek, as, you know, a form of being Greek, or do they see themselves as two separate cultures?
Suzanne, it's a really, really good question. They certainly, they consider themselves Hellenic, Hellenes. And a great example of this is that one of Alexander's ancestors, a ruler of Macedon, there was originally a debate as to whether he could compete in the Olympic Games, something that you have to be Greek to compete in. And that emphasizes that although the Macedonians viewed themselves as Greek and they were Greek, for a time at least, and I think this is very much the haughtiness certainly of certain Greek cities, they considered the Macedonians, because they were a bit further north, because they were nearer peoples who the Greeks classed as out-and-out barbarians, who spoke a different language and very much different to what the Greeks believed in and thought in, people like the Thracians in modern-day Bulgaria, they saw the Macedonians as a bit rougher around the edges. But even in the end of the day, they still considered themselves Hellenic. They were Greek. Alexander the Great spoke Greek. But he would have also considered himself a Macedonian because that was its own kingdom and it had its own kind of strong identity at the same time. So it's always such a difficult one because there was no one thing as Greece back then. Each city-state, each kingdom had its own very strong belief in its own identity. But overarchingly, they did still kind of worship the same gods. They spoke the same language. So there was still that overarching idea that they were all, what would you say, Greek. Mm.
Tristan Hughes is here with us. He's an ancient history expert. He's the host of History Hits, the ancient podcast. He's also the author of Alexander's Successes at War. Now, and I don't want to get bogged down too much in all of it because we'll never get to talk about what happened after he died. No. It's on how many questions I asked you, I think, Tristan. But I am kind of intrigued. Do you think when he set off, you know, one step at a time, really across the Persian Empire, he could have envisaged that he literally would cross the entire Persian Empire without even losing a battle? I mean, it must have been, what an incredible thing to achieve.
You know, I think it was probably a far-fetched dream because there had been Greek leaders and warlords who had crossed over and kind of fought some battles and taken some booty, raided some cities, had some success in Persian territory before, but they'd never really gone much further than Anatolia. And I do think, probably more with Alexander's father, first of all, the man who envisages this invasion of the Persian Empire, King Philip II of Macedon. I think he was probably envisaging, okay, yeah, we'll fight a few battles. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how much territory we can take or you know, kind of how far we can go in the western fringes of the Persian Empire. And then we'll reach some agreement with the Persian King of Kings, and then we'll come back to Greece, and then we'll celebrate those successes. And I think that probably with Alexander, you know, he's in his early 20s. He's a highly confident man in his own military ability. I think he probably started off thinking that way too. But as he wins successes after successes, that confidence grows. He's, of course, also fueled by this idea, I think probably forwarded by his mum as well, Olympias, and probably others around him, that he had, you know, he had divine backing, he had divine lineage. So he may well have maybe it been a distant ambition to think, oh wow, I'm going to get to the edges of the known world that I've heard about from my teachers as I've grown up, places like India, where all these strange beasts live and so on. But I think that kind of aspiration becomes more reality as time goes on and he realizes that he can get further and further, really.
So I'm going to jump, Tristan, to basically the furthest point of the journey to the east. So he got the northwest corner of India, did he? Or where's the line where he reached before he turned around?
Yes, about that. So kind of the Hyphasis River, the Jhelum River, we think of today, it's part of an eastern branch of the Indus River. So kind of modern-day Pakistan, approaching modern-day India as well. And fast forward, this is almost a decade after Alexander the Great has, well, it is a decade after he's made that first crossing. He's crossed the Dardanelles, the modern-day Dardanelles, into the Persian Empire. And he's, over that decade, he's defeated the Persians on several occasions, you know, gone to Egypt, Turkey, modern-day Iraq and Iran, captured great centers like Babylon and Persepolis and so on, campaigned in Afghanistan and Uzbekistan for a few years, really difficult fighting, guerrilla warfare out there. And then that last stage, he really wants to kind of to get further than the Persians had done, to create an empire that is at least as big as the Persian Empire had been at its height. And that last piece of the puzzle is to cross over the Hindu Kush, you know, the Pamirs, beginning of the western edge of the Himalayas into modern-day Pakistan and the Indian subcontinent. And yes, that is where he famously fights a big pitched battle against a local Indian ruler in the Indus River Valley, King Porus, who has lots and lots of battle-hardened war elephants. He defeats that king, but it's very, very difficult for his troops. And then, you know, they're crossing these extensive, these very wide rivers in the Indus River Valley. Each of them, you know, it's a big logistical task to cross. There's a lot of resistance. And the story goes that when he reaches a particular river in the eastern end of the Indus River Delta branch, or a bit further up, that he hears, or his troops hear, that there are huge Indian armies awaiting him further east, and they've got even more war elephants, and they're even more keen to resist him and to resist this invader from the west. And apparently it goes that the troops are just too tired. They followed Alexander for so long. They haven't seen their loved ones back home for more than a decade. And they tell Alexander that enough's enough. And there are enough generals that also side with the troops that Alexander gives in now.
Because for them, they must have been thinking, well, where is this going to end?
Well, there is a feeling there. And that is very much the portrayal that we get in our sources, that Alexander just wants to keep going and going and going, you know, as far as he could. There is a alternate view that actually Alexander chose to turn around at this point and he wasn't forced to. And that aligns with this idea that you do see elsewhere where Alexander the Great, and this is an argument of other scholars, certainly not myself, but very good argument, that Alexander the Great, he basically goes to the extent of what was the Persian Empire at its height, goes a bit further, makes some sacrifices, establishes a city or two, and then moves in a new direction. But yes, there, because that's not clear in the sources, because it's made sense, it comes across as if Alexander, he's being forced to turn around. How far would he have gone? It's a hypothetical question. What if he'd have gone further? How would he have fared? Would he have gone as far as China? Suzanne, we'll never know the answers to that, I'm afraid.
I'm afraid too. Is there any archaeological evidence left to illustrate this part of the journey?
There is. There are some really fascinating bits of archaeological evidence, but my favourite bit is a medallion. There's a particular type of medallion, which was kind of this, a medal that we believe was rewarded to the veterans of Alexander the Great's army who campaigned in India, particularly his Macedonian veterans, and who fought in that battle I mentioned earlier against King Porus and his elephants, his Indian army. And on this medallion, a few survive. I think there's one in the British Museum as well. Actually, I know I've seen it. It's fascinating. It shows an Indian war elephant. There are two riders on top going to the right. And chasing that war elephant is a rider with a long spear, a Ziston spear. And that's a Macedonian cavalryman. And I think that that rider is spearing the second man on top of the elephant, so the one on the rear of the elephant, as that elephant is retreating. So it's a sign of the victory of the Macedonians over this Persian king and his war elephants. And a few of those medallions have survived. So that is why it's one of my favorite artifacts that survived from the time of Alexander the Great and his conquest, because it's probably a material reward. You know, it is like a medal given to those Macedonian troops, given to those troops who fought in this last great pitched battle of Alexander the Great.
I mean, they weren't getting to go home, but at least they had the medallion. Tristan Hughes is here. We're talking about, well, we're about to get to the death of Alexander the Great. So they turn around and they're heading back west through the Persian Empire. He ends up in Babylon, and this is where he would end up dying. Do you think he had any plans of settling in Babylon, or do you think there were other plans in the works?
We get this idea, once again, there is scholarly debate about this. We get this idea that Alexander wanted Babylon to be the new center of his empire. And Babylon is one of the most important, the most prestigious cities in all of antiquity. By the time of Alexander the Great, it's got history stretching back more than 1,000 years, famous names like Hammurabi, and more recently, the likes of Nebuchadnezzar, who's also known from the Bible, of course. And so, you know, there's supposedly the Hanging Gardens, there's Great Royal Palace there as well, and is slap bang in the center of his new empire, if you consider now the western fringes to be Greece and the eastern fringes to be the Indus River Valley. And there is an argument that Alexander wanted to kind of keep his base there and maybe consolidate for a period of time. But at the same time, we know that he was already planning a new campaign on to go south and kind of an expedition to see and probably conquer the rich coastal cities of Arabia. And these cities are, you know, which linked India to the Red Sea and Egypt. So they're very much on a important trade route, and of course the gateway to Inner Arabia as well. And of course, there's also this belief, and I think it's a credible belief, that although Alexander wanted to send his new empire in Babylon, after that, he did have big plans to return west. Whether it is to deal with the tricky Athenians, which I think is actually quite high on his list. The Athenians are very proud of their previous imperial history when they had an Athenian empire, and so are a bit disgruntled at being under the foot of the Macedonians and Alexander. But maybe would he then want to go further west? Could he have gone to Italy or fought against the Carthaginians as well in North Africa? Suzanne, we'll never know, but he certainly seems like someone who was intent on doing more and more and more.
Doesn't seem like the kind of guy to just sit back and rest on his laurels, for sure. So how did he die, Tristan? Because there are quite a few theories about what happened.
All right, good. Thank you, Suzanne. We got to my, I guess this is the area that I focus more on. But yes, it is. It's a fascinating story. So Alexander, you know, he's certainly not in the best of health, even when he's just aged 32 and he's come back to Babylon. His type of leadership is defined by him being on the front ranks when he's fighting with these men, whether it's attacking cities or pitched battles against enemies. And we know that he suffers many war wounds over the course of his career, some wounds worse than others, which no doubt plays a contributing factor to a deteriorating health over time. He's lost a few of his close comrades over time as well, so he's quite grief-stricken. He's a heavy drinker. And I say all of those things first, Suzanne, because I think they're important contributing factors to what happens. So he gets back to Babylon, and he's in Babylon, and he's around that area in the center of his empire, about a year or so after returning from India. And probably in about late May time, he attends the drinking party of one of his companions, a man called Medius of Larissa, and he has a good time, and then drinks a lot, then goes to bed, and then he develops a fever. And that fever gets worse and worse over the following days. So initially, it doesn't seem that bad. He still goes around his daily duties, talking with his generals, planning the future campaigns, doing what he normally does. But then it gets so bad that he's consigned to his royal, well, to his bed in the royal palace. He then loses the ability to speak. And then by this time, his generals are starting to panic because they know that Alexander doesn't look like he's going to recover from this one. And already there's no clear sign of what's going to happen next. There's a very poignant scene where all of his soldiers, particularly his veteran Macedonian troops in particular, several thousand at this time, file past his deathbed. Alexander gives them some acknowledgement of that he recognizes their presence, like a nod of the head or a lift of the finger or something like that. And then a couple of days later, on the 10th or 11th of June, 323 BC, Suzanne, he passes away, surrounded by his seven most senior officers in his bed in the royal palace at Babylon, aged just 32.
And Tristan, apparently, as his body is still there, some of the generals even start having a fight. What was going on in the room?
Well, this is the problem. Well, not straight away, but very, very close to straight away. And not in that exact hour. But this harkens back to what I was saying earlier. There is Alexander the Great. He has one child who is illegitimate. One of his wives, he has two wives at the time, is pregnant, about 8 months pregnant. He has an elder half-brother, but this half-brother has some condition, mental condition, which means kind of like King Henry VI in England. He's not able to rule without help. So he's not the kind of Macedonian leader who's expected, you know, to lead from the front. Is what they want from a Macedonian king. So all of a sudden, these generals know that there's going to be a bit of a crisis as to what should happen next, as to who should succeed Alexander. There's a famous story that apparently Alexander says to the strongest before he dies, his famous last words. Sadly, that's probably added later as kind of, you know, with people with hindsight knowing of the chaos that happens next. As mentioned, he was mute most likely when he died. But yes, these generals then squabble amongst themselves. There are various proposals put forward as to who should become the next king, as to what should happen next. Should they install one of the generals as regent, wait for Alexander's wife to give birth, presume that there's going to be a son, presume that that son's going to live to adulthood, and then make that son king some 16 years later? That's not very popular with many of the troops because that's a long time to wait. And then there's several other theories put forwards, but no one can reach an agreement. This isn't helped by the fact that all these generals are already vying against each other. They now see each other as potential rivals in this new Alexander world. And ultimately, the soldiers decide to, the everyday rank and file, the Macedonian soldiers who had so recently just filed past the bed of Alexander, decide to take matters into their own hands. They decide to name Alexander's incompetent elder half-brother as the new king. The generals aren't happy with this. They finally unite around the fact that we don't want this guy as king. And because they're refusing to accept the choice of the soldiers then decide, they get angry. And they burst into the room in the royal palace where Alexander had died a couple of days after his death, where these generals were seeking, quite frankly, sanctuary with a few hundred of their supporters. And there is a fight. There is a fight between commanders, the former commanders of Alexander the Great on one side, and many of his infantrymen on the other side. And blood is spilt in the room where Alexander the Great died. And I just love the fact that happens only 2 days or so after Alexander's death, according to the story. And Suzanne, it's a great story of the chaos that will grip Alexander's empire on and off for the next 40 years.
Now, Tristan, had there been suspicion about his death? I mean, he goes to dinner, he catches a fever. Was there suspicion that perhaps poison may have been involved?
That becomes very prominent after his death, and it takes hold very, very quickly, actually. There are rumours that he was poisoned, but I think those rumours are very much, they're not mainstream until they are promoted in these wars of the successors, these wars that ultimately erupt between these various generals that I just mentioned. It ultimately does break out into an empire-wide struggle, because there is... The poison story is linked to one particular faction, to one particular family that was very prominent in Alexander's empire. This is a man called Antipater and his children. And Antipater had been the governor, the most senior of Alexander the Great's subordinates that Alexander had left west of the Aegean Sea in mainland Greece, Kingdom of Macedonia itself, the heartlands. And Antipater had been very prominent there. But Antipater, in the years following Alexander's death, he is very much he is opposed by Alexander the Great's formidable mother, Olympias, who becomes a big figure in this War of the Successors in the early years. And it seems likely, at least in my opinion, that Olympias and those around her very much promote this idea that Antipater had murdered Alexander the Great and Antipater's sons in particular, who were actually in Babylon at that time. And the story is that Antipater sends one of his sons to Babylon, a man called Cassander, who brings with him this vial, this horrific poison. I think it's like I said, but from the river Styx, you know, the underworld river and the like. It's meant to be very, very bad. And so much so that it's so deadly that it has to be carried in a very kind of in this big container. And what happens is this son of Antipater gets to Babylon, where another of Antipater's son is Alexander's cupbearer. And he's the man who then administers this poison to Alexander's cup at that drinking party. Alexander supposedly then feels a sharp pain and, you know, dies in agony a few days later. But I think why I want to say all that, Suzanne, is that I think with the context of that kind of the rivalries and the fighting against each other that emerges following Alexander's death, the poison narrative is promoted to deride that particular faction, that particular family. And the main sources for Alexander's death, they don't talk about the poison story at all. So I think it's a later addition in my opinion.
Tristan Hughes is with us, ancient history expert, host of History Hits, the Ancients podcast. He's the author of Alexander's Successors at War. Now, what does end up happening with the empire? I mean, Tristan, I'd always understood that, for example, it was divided up amongst some of his lieutenants. And I think, for example, in Egypt, the family that Cleopatra was part of were one of the kind of descendants of one of Alexander's generals. Is that right? Or am I barking up the wrong tree?
You are absolutely correct. So the famous Cleopatra the VII, you know, was the last pharaoh of Egypt, but a member of the Ptolemaic dynasty. And what's quite interesting, you know, Cleopatra, the name Cleopatra, it's a royal Macedonian name. Alexander the Great's full sister is also called Cleopatra. So it's harkening back all the way there to the time of Alexander. But yes, I mean, yes, a nice overview way of putting it, but before getting into the very complicated details, quite frankly, of this time of the successors, what happens, this amazing but chaotic years after Alexander's death, is that his generals divide up Alexander the Great's empire. Initially, they act as if they are just kind of holding these provinces in place for the next king to reach adulthood, because ultimately it is agreed that the infant child of Alexander the Great, that I remember I mentioned one of his wives was pregnant. She gives birth to a son, and his name is also Alexander. So he is the King Alexander IV. The idea initially is that these various generals will have command of a certain province in Alexander's empire. And these provinces are based on the Persian provinces of old. So when we talk about the Macedonian Empire, a lot of it actually harkens back to the time of the Persians. That they will remain in charge of these provinces and enjoy this power, but they will also just be waiting until Alexander's son comes of age. No, it doesn't happen that way. Alexander's son is killed by one of these generals before he reaches adulthood. Many other members of Alexander the Great's family are killed brutally in those years following Alexander the Great's death, because these generals, once they get hold of this power, they see each other, you know, their former brothers in arms. Now they see each other as rivals and potentially vicious enemies. So they fight against each other to retain their particular territories. Ptolemy in Egypt is a great example, who founds this dynasty that you mentioned, Suzanne, the Ptolemaic dynasty. He takes control of Egypt straight away because he knows how important Egypt is. It's a great, prestigious land across the River Nile. Strategically, it's able to be defended too. And he takes Egypt and he has to hold on for it. He has to defend it against other generals that he'd previously served alongside who tried to remove him from power. And Ptolemy himself, he will play a big role in it. He will take the body of Alexander the Great. He will have it buried in Egypt, which is a big moment in its own right. But he will make Egypt his spear one territory by being able to beat off these other generals who are trying to cement their own power in this new post-Alexander world.
Yeah, so Tristan, it sounds like this big empire that Alexander builds, it doesn't really last for very long. It immediately kind of gets divided. Now, we've probably got about 5 minutes maximum left to chat. So just quickly tell me, because you just mentioned that Ptolemy wants to make a big deal of bringing Alexander's body to Egypt. What does happen to Alexander's body, though?
So I call it the greatest heist in history. This, of course, there are other heists available, but I quite like this one. It's basically Alexander's body. He dies in Babylon, and for 2 years it remains there. It's mummified, it's embalmed, and there's a debate about whether Alexander's body would be taken to what is today, it is Western Egypt, the Siwa Oasis, where he'd supposedly been declared the son of Zeus, or back to Macedon. And one of these generals, Perdiccas, who's a big figure in the early years following Alexander the Great's death, he tries to have Alexander's body brought back to Macedon as part of his play to become the next king. Complicated story, I won't go into it now. Basically, Ptolemy is Perdiccas's big rival in those early years. They don't like each other at all. And Ptolemy hears word about Alexander's body starting to go westwards towards where Perdiccas is, who is in that, he's at that time, he's in Anatolia in Turkey. And what he does is Ptolemy goes up to Syria. He hijacks the body, bribes the garrison, the people, the escort, and he takes Alexander's body to Egypt, oversees its burial. And Alexander's body remains there ever since. Why it's the greatest heist is because there's an attempt by Perdiccas to retake it. And the great funeral carriage it's in, he fails. And it sparks the first great war of these successors, where Perdiccas will try and take control of Egypt from Ptolemy, but he fails. Ptolemy fights him off. Perdiccas fails in crossing the Nile River on a couple of occasions, and he fails so badly that he's then killed the night after one of these disasters by his own subordinates, and Ptolemy wins, and the body of Alexander stays in Egypt for centuries after that point.
But is it still there now? I'm sure I saw a documentary recently in which people were excavating around sites associated with Alexander in Alexandria, trying to find it. Isn't it the case that no one quite knows where it is?
We don't know. And also that's why there's so much, you know, debate about, you know, what did Alexander the Great die of? What illness did he die of? And so on. And why that's still a fun thing to also consider, because there's no body that's ever been found. There are various theories, some more far-fetched than others. But yes, most people think that Alexander the Great's body is probably still somewhere beneath Alexandria today, maybe beneath the water level, actually, because that was where the royal quarter of the Ptolemaic kings and queens was. I mean, Alexander the Great's body became a place of pagan pilgrimage for centuries. It was buried in an illustrious tomb in Alexandria, arguably his greatest legacy down to the present day, the city itself that holds his name, until we hear no mention of it at the end of the 4th century AD, which is coincidentally the time when Christianity is becoming the dominant religion in what is then the Roman Empire. But yes, Suzanne, it could well still be in Alexandria somewhere today. We don't know.
Now, before we let you go, you better tell us about the tour that you are doing, because you will be out in Australia in August, doing a number of shows in Canberra, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth, then New Zealand in Auckland, and then in Melbourne. That wraps up on Sunday, the 9th of August. What can people expect?
Oh, you can expect. So it's like an episode of the Ancients podcast where we, and I proudly say this, we nerd out with a leading expert on a particular topic of ancient history. There'll be audience interaction. There'll be a bit of an introduction by myself on my career, but the lion's share will be myself and our expert guests. We can't wait to announce them very, very shortly. And we're going to be delving into myth and history, because the topics we're going to be covering are the stories of Hercules and his labors, but also there's more to Hercules' story than just the labors. But also the myth, the Roman myth, foundation myth of Romulus and Remus. And we're going to be exploring with both of them, okay, what are these great myths that, you know, they're such well-known figures today? What are the stories? But what are the kernels of truth behind these stories? What is archaeology revealing actually about the world in which Hercules supposedly lived, the Bronze Age world of Greece, the time of Mycenaeans and so on? What is archaeology revealing about Italy in the early first millennium BC, at the time that supposedly Rome is founded? What do we actually know? So those are the topics we're going to be nerding out about with our expert.
Are you bringing the experts out? Are you collecting them when you get to Australia?
I think, well, you're going to find out, Suzanne, that we have found that people really love it when we explore you know, well-known stories, but then actually explore those potential kernels of truth behind them. Because I think that's what we all love with all of these myths, that, you know, that there are basis of truth for them.
That's absolutely right. I want to hear all the evidence that the Trojan War really happened, for example.
Yes.
Yeah, Tristan, I don't think we've got time to even touch on that now. Thank you so much for being our guest to talk about Alexander the Great tonight, and we look forward to seeing you in Australia.
Suzanne, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Have a good evening.
That's Tristan Hughes. He is an ancient history expert. He's the host of History Hits, the Ancients podcast. He's the author of Alexander's Successes at War, the Perdiccas Years. And yes, he will be in Australia. So Sunday, the 2nd of August in Canberra, Monday, the 3rd in Sydney, Tuesday, the 4th in Brisbane, Thursday, the 6th in Perth, Saturday, the 8th in Auckland, and Sunday, the 9th of August in Melbourne.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.